NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Hollywood, the dream factory, a place where celebrities are identified and fortunes made. Such fame and riches have translated into influence, glamour, and above all, control. Control of what projects get greenlit, of who gets to star, of who gets to be a star, and above all, control of image. Yet that control feels shaky right now, as stars are being eclipsed by social media sensations, plotted films by franchises, conventional studios by big tech dreamers. The fight to maintain power and illusion is more contested by ever, a fight laid bare by the exposés that helped derail powerhouse producer Harvey Weinstein, who faces criminal rape charges in a trial starting this week. This hour on Point, Hollywood's tarnished star. Join us. When you think of a celebrity these days, where does your mind turn? To Hollywood or somewhere else? How much do you care about movie stars? How closely do you listen to what they have to say? And when you select a movie to watch, why do you pick it? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitters and Facebooks at OnPoint Radio. With me here in studio in New York City, Radhika Jones. She's the editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair magazine. Vanity Fair has been at the center of covering Hollywood for decades and hosts an annual Oscar party littered with bold-faced names and blue-chip sponsors. Next week, Jones will reveal the cover of its highly anticipated annual Hollywood issue. Radhika Jones, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
So, look, I know you're going to probably do some fancy reveal, some breathtaking unveiling, right, of your annual Hollywood issue, but at minimum, without giving away trade secrets unless you want to, because you're always welcome. But at minimum, tell us, what are the themes that illuminated your thinking? What did you want to get at with this issue that might make it stand out on a pretty crowded media landscape?
It would be interesting to attempt to reveal on radio, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, right.
Of a cover. Our technology's not quite there yet. No, I'm glad you asked. The issue will be on our site on Tuesday and on newsstands a week later. And I think that the word that we were playing with over the past 6 months as we were planning it was iconic. We're looking at icons of entertainment. And as much as, you know, I'm sure we're going to talk about, as much as there is changing in Hollywood, as much as there are new players on the scene and the whole idea of entertainment and where we find it is changing and our aspirations change accordingly, there still is so much room in the American imagination for the icon. It feels like a constant to us. And we were just struck as we follow, you know, we go through the whole film circuit over the year, the festivals and the awards, and we were struck this year by how many true star-making moments we saw. I think of the Joni Mitchell phrase, the star-making machinery. It's still operative. And so we thought a lot about icons of cinema, icons of the screen writ large, how that manifests in 2020 and beyond. And that's what we're playing with.
So let's take that word, because it's a word that carries a punch, but sometimes it's open to interpretation. You can take that wherever you want. You know, is Bart Simpson an icon? Is Brad Pitt or George Clooney an icon? So who to Radhika Jones? What are the icons? Are you taking us to people who have been enduringly icons for generation? Or are you taking people who have just emerged?
I have to put like an imaginary muzzle on my mouth because, of course, I know exactly who I'm talking about on this
cover.
So
give us other examples.
But I think, you know, I've been editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair for 2 years now. And I think that I would point to my choices over the last year and a half when my cover choices started to manifest. And my sense of what's iconic these days is elastic, as I think it should be. It's dynamic. And so my first cover was Lena Waithe, who had won a historic Emmy for her work on The Showmaster of None, and at the time was in a Steven Spielberg movie. But she was starting to rise up in Hollywood as much a creator as an actor, a person who was changing the kinds of stories that were being told and bringing up a lot of people with her with a new sense of liberty as to who could be represented in Hollywood. She's a queer Black woman, and I thought this is the kind of person who belongs on the cover of Vanity Fair because to fulfill that Hollywood dream these days, there are, I think, a lot more paths than there used to be. And she is a person who represents that. And at the same time, the more traditional movie star as we think of them, the sort of iconic performer, the person who holds your attention on screen in a way that traffics in charisma, still incredibly operative. And I think of people like Lupita Nyong'o. I think of
who you also featured.
Who we've also featured on our cover. I think of Michael B. Jordan, Adam Driver, you know, who can go from art house films to a Star Wars franchise, like that versatility, that engagement, the personality that comes through in their performance, that remains incredibly important to us.
You mentioned something interesting that is a source of probably a burst of creativity, a burst of contract, but also a burst of anxiety. Ricky Gervais recently hosted the Golden Globe Awards and took aim at some of the corporate powers who have become heavy hitters in streaming entertainment. Here are his thoughts on the new Apple TV Plus program, The Morning Show, starring Jennifer Aniston, Reese Witherspoon, and Steve Carell.
A superb drama, yeah. A superb drama about the importance of dignity and doing the right thing, made by a company that runs sweatshops in China. So, well, you say you're woke, but the companies you work for, I mean, unbelievable. Apple, Amazon, Disney. If ISIS started a streaming service, you'd call your agent, wouldn't you?
Tough punchline, but at the same time, how happy is Hollywood to embrace these new sources of riches? Or am I... should we be disaggregating what Hollywood is in that moment? Because it's got to be a source of great burst of billions of dollars. That's a good thing for writers and actors and producers, but it seems to be completely destabilizing Hollywood as we've known it.
It is destabilizing Hollywood. There's a boom. Some say it's a bubble. You know, you think of terms like peak TV, like, can there possibly be more television? There's already too much. We don't know what to watch. We can't keep track of it now.
Although since that phrase was coined about 5 years ago, the amount of new scripted television has only grown significantly.
Oh, yes, yes. It's like now we just have a word for it. I come from books, and of course, the idea that you would ever be able to read all the books is completely fanciful. So, to me, I kind of think like, well, of course, you can't watch all the TV. It's different from how it used to be. But you know, this is the thing that is interesting about being at Vanity Fair in this moment and the kind of coverage that we do, because what we're talking about is an overlap among all of these corridors of power. And we have traditionally covered Hollywood, but also Silicon Valley and Wall Street and Washington and the ways in which these worlds come together. And it feels to me like they have never been more intertwined. You know, I think back to when Vanity Fair was reinvented by Tina Brown in the 80s, and one of her first covers that really broke through was a photograph of Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan dancing. And remember, back in the 80s, that was like the incursion of Hollywood into politics was scandalous, right? Ronald Reagan was an actor, and now he was the president. And could
although a two-term imagine? Governor in California, but still thought
also,
of right,
yes,
as an actor.
Also, and right. But the point is that the way that people talked about Donald Trump as a reality star coming to the White House, if you look back at the 80s, there was that, maybe not quite the same level, but there was consternation about someone coming from Hollywood into politics. Now it's like the norm, and the Silicon Valley incursion into Hollywood is another example of that. All of these worlds are overlapping, and you know, the power structure, that's where we come in. That's where our storytelling is important, because I do think that it creates an entirely new class of people who create, but also people who greenlight, people who have the financial backing to make or break certain careers, certain shows, you know, that those things can be very benevolent, and then they can also be less benevolent.
You mentioned Tina Brown. By the way, you mentioned that you came from books as though you were Athena, you know, from the brow of a book somewhere. You worked for a couple of years, for a little stretch anyway, at the New York Times Book Review, as working at Time Magazine before that.
I think I meant more broadly, you know, literature was probably my first love. So as an editor, I also consider myself a professional reader. So
you mentioned, and close reader of magazines is part of that, you mentioned Tina Brown. She was Vanity Fair from 1983 to 92 after its acquisition by the Newhouse publishing family. She was widely credited with imbuing the magazine with a strong sensibility. She embraced celebrity. She embraced controversy. Mm-hmm. In November 2017, she embraced you. She offered this endorsement of Radhika Jones as the new editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair in this interview on CBS This Morning.
I think Renika Jones will be a terrific choice. She's young, you know, which I like. She's very literary. She has intellectual rigor. And I think she's going to bring a new broom, actually, to the whole situation.
A new broom.
So tell us about that broom, Renika Jones. What have you done, with a couple minutes before this first break, what have you done in changing or reinventing Vanity Fair as you thought about its relationship to covering celebrity and thought about its relationship to covering Hollywood?
Well, it seemed to me, if we go back to when Tina gave that very gracious interview and when I was taking the job, it was the autumn of the Harvey Weinstein story. So it was very clear to me in taking on a magazine like Vanity Fair that there was a seismic change going on, not just in Hollywood, not just in Washington, also as the Trump administration rounded out its first year, but also in the expectation of audiences and readers as to how media outlets should be speaking truth to power, what our responsibility is to do that, and also just how we could simultaneously start to lead the culture and also reflect the culture that was changing very rapidly. And so I take those things very seriously.
There were times where Vanity Fair was characterized as sort of having been a little bit enthralled to the celebrity nature of Hollywood rather than sort of also taking into account the truth to power nature of what one does in journalism.
Right. And there's a balance. We are very supportive of excellent work and quality and talent, and that's a part of our coverage. We love Baby Yoda as much as the next person. We're human.
And you're going to be doing all of that. Even as we're speaking, there are dramatic protests happening outside a courtroom in downtown New York City over Harvey Weinstein's trial. We'll be discussing that. We're discussing right now the media's role in portraying Hollywood. Is it in its completeness? We're going to talk about that with the editor of Vanity Fair magazine. Join our conversation. How has your interest in Hollywood changed over the years? Who are the celebrities you pay attention to and why? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing how the press covers Hollywood and how Hollywood handles the press and the nature of celebrity in the 21st century. You can join our conversation. Where do you seek out information about Hollywood, its famous names, its rising stars, and other aspects that intrigue you? What do you make of what you've learned about the movie business from the Harvey Weinstein scandal? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll be joined later this hour by one of the leading reporters on the Harvey Weinstein scandal. With me right now here in studio in New York City, Renika Jones. She's editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair magazine. Let's talk a little bit about we've mentioned the question of streaming, right? And we can get back to that a little bit, how that infuses money, how that changes who the players are. The digital moment has also changed the way in which Hollywood figures get to interact with the public, right? They can communicate directly. They can say, we don't have to do NPR, although thankfully they do. They can say, we don't have to talk to Vanity Fair, although they generally do or often do. But it's in some ways a negotiation. How do you navigate the question of access and the question of coverage with figures that you really want to take a look at? I know that there was an interview that ran in the public in Vanity Fair after you took over, but had been planned before you were on board with Jennifer Lawrence. But you think of somebody of that kind of stature. Mm-hmm. What are you willing to do in the back and forth to figure out, okay, I want the interview with you. I'm willing to talk about your latest project, but I also want to get some stuff here that that may not be what you're promoting.
I am very buoyed and supported by the expectations of our readers because I know that our readers are sophisticated and they want to be entertained, but they never want to be talked down to, and they can smell a publicity tour a mile away. And I think that, you know, the history and legacy of our brand is such that We cover entertainment. We cover society in certain ways. We cover scandal. We cover politics. But the expectation of our readers is that we are coming behind the curtain a little bit on that. And I came up in journalistic newsrooms at Time Magazine, at the New York Times. And so it's pretty simple for me. My feeling is that our job is to be journalists, and we will come and ask the questions. And I don't really ever want any questions to be off the table. Now, how someone answers a question, that's up to them. We can't control that. But
So give me an example, though. Give listeners a feel for what it's like. Because also, part of the deal, although you guys now occasionally will post videos of certain kinds of back mm-hmm. and forths, but they tend not to be supercharged, right? Give us a feel for a moment where you guys are like, look, we're interested in this person for who she or he is. Mm-hmm. We're interested in their creative mind. We're interested in their fame. We're interested in all of it. But you know what? We're going to get at this a little bit, and you have to figure out how to keep it on track to get what you want and still produce, you know, a complete piece.
Well, one piece—
Because there's that tension, as it is in politics, other things. But with celebrity, either you have it or you don't. Or else you do it like, Frank Sinatra has a cold and you write around it, right?
Right, right. And I will say, leaving Hollywood aside for a moment, that sometimes in this day and age— access is actually not the way that you're going to get the best story. Mm-hmm. I think particularly in politics, these days, if you have access to the inner circle of the White House, you don't really know, are you getting the true story or are you not? So,
In Hollywood.
Be the same in Hollywood. We have these conversations. I'm sure you have them too. They're pressing journalistic conversations. I think about a really terrific piece that we ran in November. It was a cover profile of Joaquin Phoenix, mm-hmm. Who is a great subject of fascination to me. I'm a Gen Xer.
Me too.
I fell in love with River Phoenix as a young woman, like many other people. I don't want to speak for everyone.
Yeah.
Yes, both brilliant actors. I've loved Joaquin's work. If Walk the Line is on any channel on television, I will always watch
it. It's a remote drop.
There it is. There it is. Right. And he's had such an interesting career, unorthodox in certain ways, and he's kind of iconoclastic, and he's so fascinating. And we sent Joe Hagan to profile him. Mm-hmm. Joe wrote the recent biography of Jan Wenner, Stevie
Very,
Fingers,
very well regarded.
And very well regarded. Not necessarily a traditional profiler of celebrities, but someone who is a true journalist and comes with the expectation that we're going to spend some time together and we're going to get to know the subject of this piece. And that it's not that there's some scandal to uncover. It's more just when you come to the end of this piece about Joaquin Phoenix, you feel that you have been with him.
Well, and one of the complicated things that you're being too kind to say, it would seem to me from the outside, is Phoenix is an unreliable narrator. Like Joaquin Phoenix, he did this whole stunt where he, showed up on Letterman and you couldn't tell if he was semi-comatose or what was going on. Like there are times where he is elusive and at times where it seems to me he's been misleading, even as he's a totally intriguing figure and a terrific actor.
In that sense, he's the consummate actor, I would say. And he also was involved in a movie that was becoming increasingly controversial before it was released, The Joker, mm-hmm. which a lot of people had a lot of legitimate concerns about. And so those are questions that can be difficult for a director, for an actor to kind of game out, what is this role, is this movie, is this a good thing, is this a bad thing? We live in this moment where the culture is really under a microscope, where there's a lot of fear and a lot of outrage and anticipation about major cultural events. And so we covered all of those things and people kept reading that story for weeks. Because as the movie came out and there was more and more dialogue about it, some of the things that Joaquin and the director had said in our story, led to more coverage. And it was really, in my mind, the ideal place for us to be. So I think, one of the things we talk about expectation, one of the things that we always strive for is time. So just time with a subject. And again, the ability to kind of talk about more than just here's the current project, but also what brought you here and why does this matter and why do we care about it? Because there are a lot of movies, there are a lot of television shows, there are, a lot of people in that space. And when we're choosing to cover someone, we need to deliver on that promise that if we're taking the reader along, there's going to be some discovery.
You hold an annual Oscar party. They'll be in a couple of months. That's one of the year's most highly coveted invites on the West Coast. Late night talk show host Stephen Colbert, certainly pleased to receive his invite to this year's party. It was hand-delivered by you, Radhika Jones, during your most recent visit over to the Ed Sullivan Theater back in October.
Radhika Jones invites Mr. and Mrs. Stephen Colbert for dinner to celebrate the 92nd Academy Awards, Sunday, February 9th, 2020. Black tie. I own one of those. I accept. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.
It's actually only a month from now. Now, Colbert, as I understand it, claimed to have not been invited to the Vanity Fair Oscar party the previous year and expressed his dismay and outrage during your earlier appearance on the show. Any chance to tweak you, I think, should not be overlooked.
I'm here to tell you that that was fake news.
Fake news!
Fake news.
Stephen Colbert, formerly a satiric cable news host, now offering fake news over on CBS.
Also the consummate actor.
Right now shattering icons even as we speak.
I got in real trouble for that because then my mother watched and called me and said, well, where's my invitation? And, you know, we're still smoothing that out.
I wish you every good fortune on that. So talk to me about walking that line. You are holding a party right in the heart of Hollywood, probably not quite as flagrantly opulent as it once was, but nonetheless still pretty swank. A lot of top-tier names, a lot of nominees, a lot of people invited to the first wave. As I understand it, journalists are allowed to trickle in at the end, you know, in small batches. But nonetheless, you know, at a time where we've seen people like Brett Ratner, people like Kevin Spacey, you know, former CBS chairman and studio chief Les Moonves have been brought down by credible and sustained accusations of real misconduct towards colleagues. You are also intimately enmeshed in socializing with these folks, with celebrating these folks, with not just reporting on these folks, but being kind of amongst these folks. Your predecessor, Graydon Carter, kind of swanned around and enjoyed being of them in a certain way. He'd appeared occasionally in movies. He made sure to be a producer on a number of films. And look, there was a time where every publication wanted there to be some funnel of ideas going to Hollywood so they could have other additional revenue sources. And I'm sure Vanity Fair still has those lines out as well. How do you navigate that dual relationship? It's like two or three different line sources of energy working in slightly different directions.
It's what makes me describe my job as unique. Honestly, it is. It's a really interesting and incredibly amazing portfolio to have. You know, because these days, and you don't have to be at Vanity Fair to say this, the editor-in-chief is no longer simply behind the desk with a pencil. It's been that way for a long time. I mean, we go on television. We host conferences. We do live events. All of those kinds of things now are part of the business. And I think even others of my colleagues at Condé Nast, at Wired, at The New Yorker, at GQ, you know, we all balance these different responsibilities. The thing that I love about our Oscar party, and I've now done it for 2 years, and yes, it's coming up in less than a month.
Yeah.
So we are all madly running around getting ready, is that it is the celebratory function of the job. And, you know, obviously we keep a very close eye on the guest list. But one of the things that energizes me and has done for the last 2 years very much about that party is bringing in particularly the people who are new to the Hollywood scene, the up-and-coming actors, the up-and-coming writers, directors, creators, the people who for years and years maybe felt that they were outside of this system. And through this party, I can bring them in. The first year that I held it, we have a portrait studio on site, and a number of Black and African American guests during dinner and the early part of the party went and all stood together and made a photograph, a group portrait. And when you look at that picture, it is a statement about what Hollywood is now and where it's headed. And I'm really proud of that picture. I'm proud that we can convene people together at a moment where they're able to say, "Oh, I'm no longer on the outside looking in. I'm here. I'm within the structure of power," and that is a way to affect change.
I wanted to play a clip. It's from a rival publication, forgive me, but nonetheless, Lulu Wang is a Chinese-American film director, writer, and producer. She has said she turned down significantly more money from a major streaming service to produce her acclaimed movie, The Farewell, which was inspired by the illness of her grandmother, her own immigrant family. And she made it with A24, an independent film studio. Wang spoke last month during an appearance on the Hollywood Reporter's Director Roundtable.
One thing we sometimes don't talk about with some of these bigger streaming platforms is that, you know, it's a different business model. It's not necessarily about making money back. It's about brand. They're building their brand. Mm. And when you're an established filmmaker, you are a brand that they want to partner with to help build their own brand. But with newer filmmakers, newer voices, you don't have a brand. You need to build that brand.
So what do you think about that? Within Hollywood, are the new forces, the disruptive forces throwing around billions, and I want to make clear, extra billions of dollars a year apiece in ultimately in scripted entertainment. Are they providing new opportunities for people to break out, or is that in some ways, are they going for things that they know are desired quantities already? And does that make it harder for these people who may want to be true to their own voice and vision?
I think they are providing opportunities, but it's not the only path. I mean, I think Lulu Wang is very smart about that. And I think that everybody, you know, one thing that, and I say this to people who are going into journalism now too, it's like, it can be daunting. When you make choices about who, for example, is going to produce or distribute your film, you're choosing a particular path to get your piece of art into the world. And that's incredibly personal as well as economic and professional. I think that there are ways in which if you are a Ryan Murphy, a Shonda Rhimes, someone with a particular track record and you command incredible value in the market and you sign up with Netflix and you have an enormous deal, you know, not everybody who's signing up with Netflix is getting that level of financial support. But when you look at what people like Ryan Murphy and Shonda Rhimes have done for the industry, the kinds of talent they have employed, the kinds of storytelling they have done, I think of Pose, I think of Scandal, you know, it's like that's they are able to open the tent in their own way. Mm-hmm. And then the more, you know, the A24s of the world are able to support talent in their way. I think there's room for both.
I want to take a quick call now from Lexington, Kentucky. Christian, thanks for listening. What are your thoughts?
Hi, just two quick comments. I'm a longtime reader of Vanity Fair, and I love they finally have a woman as editor-in-chief. I think Ms. Jones is doing an incredible job. And I've been reading ever since my daughter was 4 years old. She's 13. She and I would go through the magazine, flip pages, and talk about who looks the healthiest. And it's interesting now as a young teenager, I want to transition to my second point. Mm-hmm. I love the articles, and I love the fact that there is a more journalistic perspective being shared, because my daughter loves that. And you asked for Hollywood actors, stars that we think represent our views. And on behalf of my daughter, I'll just say Viggo Mortensen and Charlize Theron. And keep up the great work.
Well, thanks to you and thanks to your daughter as well for paying attention to Vanity Fair and maybe giving us a listen too. Before this next break, I wanted to ask you briefly, you were preceded in your job by a Canadian and a Brit. Mexit, the question of Harry and Meghan Markle from apparently the British family, dropping the mic, dropping the crown, and hopping over to this side of the pond. Canada, I believe, is where Meghan Markle, the Duchess of Sussex, is currently. How big a story is that for a magazine that is no longer want to be as bathed in nostalgia as perhaps it once was? And we've got about a minute left before break.
I am so glad you asked, because it's just been the talk of the newsroom for the past however long it's been, 36 hours. I know there's a lot of news in the world right now, but that was quite a doozy.
Sure.
Tina Brown, when she was editor-in-chief, she wrote this fantastic piece about Princess Diana. And it's been in the DNA of Vanity Fair since then to cover the royal family in Britain. Diana, remember, was not simply a princess. She was a kind of uber celebrity. I mean, she raised celebrity to a different level. And that is very much our bailiwick. So to me, And this latest move by Meghan and Harry is kind of confirmation of it. There is a new modernity happening in that family that is fascinating. And the idea that they are walking away from certain trappings of royalty, but quite possibly en route to Ted Sarandos's office to get themselves a nice Netflix deal. You know,
it's, like the Obamas.
Like the Obamas. I mean, that was my first thought. It's an interesting development in kind of power and aspiration and all of the things.
Prominent celebrity, the Duchess, right. Of course, a former actress,
right.
A former Hollywood star of sorts on a lower right. level. It's transcendent now in global recognition. We're talking about Hollywood. We're talking about celebrity. We're talking about image. After this brief break, we'll look at the lessons from how the press covered Harvey Weinstein before his fall and before the Me Too movement. You can join our conversation. How have the Weinstein revelations affected how you think about Hollywood? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We've been discussing Hollywood, celebrity, and image with Radhika Jones. She's editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. Exhibit A of Hollywood power gone awry, Harvey Weinstein. His rape trial began this week right here in New York City. The charges and testimonials of those who accused him put a spotlight on, among other things, press coverage of Weinstein and Hollywood before the Me Too movement began. You can join our conversation. How does the lens of Me Too influence how you view Hollywood now? Or how you see Harvey Weinstein. What questions do you have for my guests? Follow us on the Twitters and the Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now here in studio in New York City is Jodi Kantor. She's Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New York Times. She and her colleague Megan Tuohy of The Times were the first to break the news about Harvey Weinstein's decades of abuse toward women. Together, they wrote the best-selling book from last year, She Said, Breaking the Sexual Harassment Story That Helped Ignite a Movement. Jodi Kantor, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So this morning you were at a protest earlier outside the courtroom at which Harvey Weinstein is facing state charges of rape, I believe. Walk through us the events a little bit of what happened this week. What's Harvey Weinstein facing here in New York? And what other news did we learn this week about his criminal exposure?
Well, the Harvey Weinstein trial got off to a dramatic and unexpectedly dramatic start, because here we are on Monday in the courtroom. It's supposed to be a kind of procedural gathering. I'm downstairs on the street with a bunch of alleged Weinstein victims. They're feeling like I'm not part of this trial, and they're sort of underlining one of the concerns going into the trial, which is that for all of the overwhelming number of allegations against Weinstein, the New York criminal case is pretty narrow. It's based on the stories of essentially two women, with other women as supporting witnesses. So, you know, the morning's proceedings go on. He makes an appearance at the courthouse. It's just sort of dramatic to, you know, watch him walk in with that walker he's using. But lo and behold, the New York proceedings have barely adjourned when prosecutors in LA announce that they are also bringing charges. So there's this feeling of like, whoa, his criminal exposure has just doubled. There are going to be two trials. Now, LA will wait for New York. So really nothing is happening in LA now. But we know that if he's acquitted in New York, he will likely face trial in LA.
So this is going to be something he faces for quite some time. The judge also, from the reporting of The Times and other folks there, my colleagues at NPR present in the courtroom, sounded like the judge was not too sympathetic or impressed by Weinstein. Weinstein, you mentioned the walker. You know, I have great sympathy for anybody recovering from surgery. At the same time, I'm also seeing a ton of people saying, I don't even know if that's real. If he needs that, is that a play for sympathy? Is he trying to look pathetic rather than the towering figure he once presented to all these aspiring starlets, right?
You know, my own experience from the Weinstein story, and we describe this in our book, is that even when you're trying to be fair to Harvey Weinstein, he can be a very difficult guy to deal with. You know, we had this sort of like final frenzy of confrontation before him, with him before we published our story. And we were trying to get his response. We were trying to give him his moment, trying to be fair. And he was like fighting us and in such a difficult way that it made it really hard to do that. And so it was interesting to watch what has happened with the judge. The judge also summer and fall has been showing some signs of impatience with Weinstein. Weinstein was accused of tampering with his ankle bracelet monitor. He already used his cell phone in court in a way that he wasn't supposed to. And so there was this moment this week when the judge really lost patience and actually said, is this how you want to get into jail for the rest of your life from using a cell phone in a courtroom? And then the Weinstein team tried to kind of make it an issue and say, oh, you know, the judge is prejudiced against this defendant.
Right. I mean, it seemed to me a pretty good way for his lawyers, knowing that the judge is exceptionally unlikely to disqualify himself, a pretty good way for his lawyers to tick him off in the opening hours of this proceedings.
Well, remember that in this kind of proceeding, the prosecution does not get an appeal, but the defendant can. So, you know, maybe he'll have a chance to say, like, look, this judge was not fair to me. We had a really bad relationship, et cetera, et cetera. But Harvey Weinstein already has kind of an established pattern of being incredibly difficult throughout this trial. Remember, he has cycled through defense lawyer after defense lawyer. And actually, Vanity Fair just published this great profile of Donna Rotunno, who's currently Harvey Weinstein's defense lawyer. But part of what it described is that some of his previous lawyers are pretty open about him being a rough client to deal with.
And before I turn to Radhika Jones a little bit about that, you talked in your book and you talked just now or alluded just now to how it was dealing with Harvey before your story hit. And let's also acknowledge the incredible work Ronan Farrow did for The New Yorker following you guys and sort of working in parallel on very similar lines. These two powerhouse exposés really stripped naked, perhaps a poor choice of terms, but nonetheless laid bare, you know, the denigrations, the degradation that he that scores of women have come forward now to say that he imposed upon them. Harvey Weinstein was used to working the press. Harvey Weinstein was used to controlling the press. Harvey Weinstein was used to dictating the press. My friend and former colleague, Kim Masters, now The Hollywood Reporter, talks about how when she was investigating a guy he was working closely with, who at that time headed Amazon Studios, he basically out of nowhere proposed that he would publish a book by hers and his book imprint. And she's like, there's no way I'm doing that, Harvey. But there were a lot of people who were seduced professionally, who were intimidated, who were neutralized along the way. How did Harvey Weinstein do that?
I do think he was incredibly used to just using his influence. You know, I got to tell you, behind the scenes, the number of phone calls that he placed to Dean Baquet, to our publisher.
Your editor-in-chief.
Yeah, exactly. And there was this sense of like, I'm an important man. You're an important man. Let's go into the room where all the important men work out their stuff. And we're going to, you know, we're going to settle this right there. And he used more explicit forms of leverage as well. For instance, reminding the Times that he had been a big advertiser over the years and really contributed to the paper's bottom line. Now, what he clearly didn't understand is that this was never going to work at the Times. And maybe that's why he turned to some of these more sort of exotic methods, like hiring the Black Cube operatives to sic on us and try to manipulate our reporting. But I think, you know, part of what we probed in this book and found an even greater pattern is we wanted to ask the question, how was this guy able to create his own reality for so long? How could he push his way through the world and other people, smart people, influential people, would just fall in line? And you know, remember that the moral horror of the Harvey Weinstein story is, how did this guy accumulate 40 years worth of allegations and other people
without instead being checked somewhere along the way?
Other people, instead of stopping him, they helped him.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a call now from Waldoboro, Maine. Jim, thanks for listening. Thanks for waiting. What are you hearing, what you're listening to now?
Hello. Thanks for joining. Thanks for letting me join. I have to tell you, I'm somewhat incredulous at this conversation. I mean, Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey Epstein, and Roman Polanski are all of the same cloth. Hollywood, mm-hmm. at an awards ceremony just a few years ago, stood up and applauded Roman Polanski, who was convicted of rape. So, I mean, it simply confirms for me how really corrupt and decadent our elites in Hollywood and New York, among other cities, have become.
Okay. Well, thanks for that, Jim. You know, Radhika Jones, Jim's raising a point. There are a lot of folks. Roman Polanski was celebrated even after he was convicted in absentia for raping an underage girl. And to this day has still made movies in recent years periodically, for which he has been celebrated and applauded and lauded. When you hear Jodie Kantor talk about the arc of Harvey Weinstein, how the scandal sort of – it took a huge scandal to break through all these allegations and let them all come pouring out. You know, Tina Brown, one of your predecessors that we mentioned earlier in the hour, she went into business with him. She founded Talk Magazine with Miramax, which was at that time the Weinstein Brothers company. What lessons do you draw from what you've learned from the reporting of Jodie Kantor and Megan Tuohy at the New York Times and others on this case?
Well, one of the things I often think of is that after or as such stories are coming out, there's often a lot of talk about how it was an open secret. Mm-hmm. This idea that it was an open secret, everybody kind of knew everybody. But Jodie knows better than anybody that the road from open secret to something that is journalistically reportable is a long and arduous one. And everybody, I mean, because I was in the media too and I had interacted with Harvey, he had whatever else he did have that reputation as a bully. And one of the things that the whole unfolding of this, not just the story, but all of the kind of the reckoning that has passed since then, is that I think we are all a little bit more attuned to that terminology around, oh, it's an open secret, or, oh, you don't want to be in the office with that guy alone. I mean, these are things that I heard over my career as a journalist and mm-hmm. Sharing offices with some of the people who ended up being, dethroned from their powerful positions by the Me Too movement. What it does for me as someone who is in a position of now to greenlight investigations and storytelling is pay attention to the quote unquote open secret.
So let's
push on those buttons as much as you can.
Let's hear one of the voices that Jodie Kantor and colleague Megan Tuohy helped to bring to the fore, and who you talk about in your book, how you were able to get her to talk to you. As Weinstein's criminal trial got underway this week here in New York City, several of his accusers gathered to show solidarity and support with one another, including the actor Rose McGowan. She spoke on Monday on the court steps here in New York. She says Weinstein raped her at the Sundance Film Festival in 1997.
Dear Harvey, no matter what lies you tell yourself, you did this. Today, Lady Justice is staring down a super predator. You.
Now, Harvey Weinstein, just for the record, through his lawyers, has denied that he did this to Rose McGowan. But this is a part of a pattern of behavior, and she has been saying this for some time in different ways in Hollywood, and it took a little bit to get her to talk to you. In your book, you talk about how tough it was to get – I thought this was fascinating – Gwyneth Paltrow to talk to you. Here is a star of the First Order, right? Here's someone who has, in a sense, stepped a bit out of Hollywood, even though she shows up in the Iron Man films and some other films. She basically stepped out of Hollywood to do her personal kind of health and wellness thing, Goop. And it seemingly would be away from the implications of what could happen to her. And in that first go through, that first round, you think she's going to do it. She's going to talk to you. She's going to confirm not an allegation of rape, but an allegation of severe sexual harassment, so severe that her then boyfriend more than 2 decades ago, Brad Pitt, basically said, if you do that again to Weinstein, he said, I'll come after you. And she just couldn't do it. She was too worried about it. She's worried about blowback. She's worried about the implications. What does that say to you about somebody at the apex having that kind of fear and reaction to the idea of coming forward in her own voice?
Well, getting Gwyneth to speak to us was not hard. In fact, early in the investigation, at a time when basically nobody in Hollywood would pick up the phone to us, Gwyneth did get on the phone and she did tell us her story. And not only that, but she Gwyneth is sort of a perfectionist, and she really wanted to learn about investigative journalism and help us. She spent a lot of time contacting other women.
So an invaluable source and resource.
In Hollywood, yeah. And those – but even she had a lot of trouble getting other women to talk to us. Then when the final moment came before publication and we were really – trying to get her to go on the record. And in fact, I mean, it's always a delicate balance because every woman has to make the choice. And so to be honest, I was applying so much pressure to her that I thought I was going to lose her, you know, because my attitude was like, she doesn't need this. Like, she has everything. And she was really, really torn. Part of the problem for her is that everybody close to her was telling her not to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, I understood the logic of the investigation. She understood the logic of the investigation. But, you know, these people around her, why would you do this? And they had a fair point. It's really unfair that women have to do the messy work of telling these stories when the women really didn't do anything wrong to begin with. And by the way, we are seeing that pattern repeated right now, because part of what you're going to see in the New York criminal trial, and this may be true in LA as well, is that on the one hand, we're going to hear some women's voices, but it's going to feel narrow compared to the whole and the size and the scale of the Weinstein allegations. And that's because we described this on an episode of The Daily today, the New York Times podcast. There are still women afraid to come forward and afraid to cooperate with prosecutors. Think about being what it means to be a witness in either of these trials in New York or LA. Some of these women we think have a shot at remaining anonymous. Some of them we think may not. They are going to be grilled. I'm sure private investigators are looking into their backgrounds. They're going to have to face cross-examination. What do they get in the end? They do get the public service of having contributed to this, but they get very little else, and they may lose something.
Last comment before we go. We got about a minute left for Deka Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. Is journalism, you know, caught up in this at the moment, or has this and what ensued change the way journalism and journalists think about these issues of power and control and behavior for the long term?
I think both. I think there's also a question of whether it's for some reason, whatever it was, and maybe you have a theory, Jody, audiences, readers were ready to listen this time. They were ready to hear it. And that, I think, speaks to a lot of frustration and rage among women, among people who have wanted the system to change, whether they be women or men, but they were ready to hear it. And it does also point to something changing in Hollywood. Part of the reason that women don't speak up is because they feel that maybe this happened only to them. They're in isolation. When you have more roles for women, when you have women sharing time on screen and sharing experiences, you're going to get more solidarity.
And more positions of power as well. We've been hearing those last words from Deka Jones. She's editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. Her magazine's annual Hollywood issue will make its debut in the stands next week. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we've also been joined here in studio by Jody Kantor. She's Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the New York Times, co-author of the book She Said, Breaking the Sexual Harassment Story That Helped Ignite the Movement. Thanks to you as well, Jody.
Thank you.
You continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik. You've been listening to On Point. Thank you.